Blog Talk Radio.
The Hallicasser Jane Show Talk Radio for Fine Minds airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallicasserJane.com. And thank you so much for joining me. I am Hallicasser Jane. Today on the Hallicasser Jane Show, I look at the writers, artists, and muses that were the heart of a revolution. They are called the Beat Generation, and you are about to discover with my guests, authors Alan Kaufman and Brenda Knight, and with the founder and curator of the Beat Museum in San Francisco, Jerry Cimino, why they were called just that. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You're listening to the Hallicasser Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds. The Hallicasser Jane Show is always available online at HallicasserJane.com. Today, the Hallicasser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallicasser Jane Show. Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org. Jerry Cimino is the founder of the Beat Museum, which began in 2003 in Monterey, California, and moved to San Francisco in 2006. The museum is dedicated to spreading the spirit of the Beat Generation, which is defined as tolerance, compassion, and having the courage to live individual truth. The Beat Museum is home to an extensive collection of Beat memorabilia, including original manuscripts and first editions, letters, personal effects, and cultural memorabilia. I want to welcome to the Hallicasser Jane Show, Jerry Cimino. It's so, so nice to have you here. Hi, Jerry. How are you today?
Very good, Hallie. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, well, I'm telling you, I'm really glad to have you here. But before we talk about the Beat Generation, let's talk a little bit about you. I find it fascinating.
Okay.
How'd you get knee-deep into all of this so much that you and your wife started this museum?
Well, I just happened to stumble upon the writings when I was a young man. When I was 14 years old, actually, I read some poetry by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And it was introduced to me by an English teacher back in Baltimore, Maryland. It was 1968, and everything was happening. The world was exploding in 1968, and there was so much uncertainty. And reading Ferlinghetti's poems really resonated for me.
Changed your life, apparently, yes.
Well, yes, I dedicated the last 10 years of my life literally to all of this, and fortunately had a chance to meet so many of the people over the years, all the poets and writers, and it's been a very, a very fulfilling mission, I think.
And a good one at that. So tell me this. Give me a little background here. World War II ends, and then the Beat Generation. Times were ripe for a counterculture. Is that so?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, interestingly enough, times are always ripe for a counterculture. There's always been a counterculture. You know, the Greeks and the Romans had their countercultures. But the thing about the Beat Generation, in my opinion, is that they basically came of age with a time of mass communication. And the advantage that the Beats had over every other counterculture in history is they had electronic media. They had radio and television. So Allen Ginsberg's poetry literally went around the world in the 1950s and the 1960s when he got very famous. But you're right, they were friends.
Right.
They were friends in the 1940s, and then they They supported each other's works, and that's how they all, you know, got published and became, you know, household names for a lot of people.
So counterculture, where did it start? I think didn't it start in New York originally, this whole movement?
Yes, you can fairly say that it started in New York because they were all in the New York area. Some of them went to Columbia. Some of them were hanging around Times Square. They got to know each other socially. They were all, you know, trying their hands at writing and poetry, and they kind of recognized kindred spirits in a sense. And then they wound up, some of them got published, some of them got famous. It was the Howell trial that really put them on the map. In 1955, Allen Ginsberg wrote Howell. It was published by Lawrence Ferlinghetti City Lights Bookstore in 1956. And in 1957, Ferlinghetti was arrested and put on trial for obscenity for a book of poetry, which is rather shocking. But at the same time, there were four-letter words that were in this book and topics that a lot of people didn't deem appropriate. And so he literally had to stand trial. And he could have gone to jail for years for publishing a book of poetry. The flip side of that, of course, is it's what put the Beats on the map. Had there not been an obscenity trial, it's very likely we wouldn't be talking about them because that's what made them famous.
So the Beats, the Beat Generation, tell everybody how they got that name.
Well, there's a lot of legend and lore around the Beat Generation, and this is one of the areas of how the word came about. And most scholars and people that know about this attribute it to a guy named Herbert Hunky, who was known as Hunky the Junkie. He was a Times Square hustler. And after World War II, he just happened to use that terminology, man, I'm really beat, I'm tired, I'm worn out, I'm broken. And he was a friend of Kerouac's, and they kind of coined the term, man, we're a beat generation. But interestingly enough, once he got some fame and some notoriety, Kerouac consciously changed the term from one of meaning broken down and worn out to one of meaning compassionate and sympathetic to your fellow man. For Kerouac, he was Catholic, and the Mass of the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, was a big deal for him. And so, you know, being Catholic, the Beatitudes was a big deal for him. So he shifted it to more of a religious connotation. The Beat Generation, meaning holy and sympathetic to your fellow man, which I like a lot, actually.
That's a great thing. Were you going to say something?
Because the beats really, it was about a spiritual quest. You know, you mentioned in the intro about tolerance and compassion and having the courage to live your own individual truth, which is my terminology for this, but the reason I say it that way is because it really was, in my opinion, a spiritual quest. The Beats were seekers. They were looking for answers, and they were always asking questions. And they were not out necessarily to convey to other people how they had to live their lives. They were looking how they wanted to live their own lives. And many of them had very dysfunctional lives. There was a lot of alcoholism. There was a lot of drug addiction. There were murders, for God's sake. There were all kinds of things that happened.
We'll get into that in a little bit, absolutely. But let me take a step. No, absolutely, we're going to get there. But I want to get to Jack Kerouac. You know, we all assume, and I think all of us are of a certain age, that everybody knows these people. You know, and I think that was true of our generation. I'm not so sure how true it is of future generations, which is one of the reasons I wanted to do this show. But Jack Kerouac is, in your opinion, the father of the Beat Generation, and if so, why him? And give us a little background on him and his writing, and, of course, how can you talk about him and not the infamous On the Road? Give us a little Kerouac.
Well, Kerouac was born in 1922 in Lowell, Massachusetts, and he was a football hero. He was a jock, and that's what got him out of his small town. He got a scholarship to Columbia, which allowed him to go to the big city, and that's where he met Ginsberg, and that's where he met Burroughs. And a lot of people do call him the father of the Beat Generation for a number of reasons. He was the main novelist. He's the one who got the most famous. He had movie star good looks. And what's really, I think, important regarding Jack is he died young. You know, the thing about the Beat Generation, the two foremost characters, Neal Cassady, who was the main character of the book On the Road, which is a true story, and Jack Kerouac, who was the observer who wrote the book, they They both died in their 40s. And there's this iconic photograph taken of them by Carolyn Cassidy in 1952 here in San Francisco. And in it, they're standing arm-in-arm, buddy. It's the quintessential buddy photo of two young men in the prime of their youth, I guess you could say. And they look like brothers. They look healthy and strong, and they're both, again, drop-dead good-looking. And Kerouac was a hell of a writer, and his works really resonated with a lot of people. And then he had a bad ending. He fell into alcoholism, never got out of the bottle, and it's what literally took him down. And a lot of people, I think, identify with Kerouac's works because everybody he writes about, in my opinion, is a sympathetic character. They can be doing the most dastardly things, like Neil Cassidy leaving his wife for another woman, leaving the children, abandoning his family, stealing money from his friends, stealing cars all the time. And yet you still love him because he's this lovable louse. He's this holy con man. Jack calls him the holy goose. And so even though he's on the edge, as many of these people were, they were on the edge of society, you still love him. You wouldn't want him to marry your sister, but you'd like to hang out with him and party with him.
So fair to say. Yeah, no, I'm laughing at that because it's so true. But they were thinkers. They were philosophers of the sort. They didn't take life sitting down. Fair to say that they could have been called, you can call them anarchists, or were they simply testing staid waters? These are thoughts that came to my mind. Merely, what, nonconformists, or are they inherently messed up, psychologically damaged generation, you know, angry, misguided? How you could go any way you want on that, I suspect. Is that an individual choice?
Yeah, I think it is individual. Some of them had psychological issues probably, and some of them were certainly, you know, some of the people involved would have been anarchists, or you could say any way you want. I mean, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who really doesn't consider himself a beat, he considers himself a bohemian. He considers himself the publisher of the beats, but he was also a businessman, but he's always considered himself an anarchist. And the beat generation, if you think about it, they were the exact same age as what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation. And for me, that's one of the reasons I kind of got into this. I stumbled into this because they were all born almost within a year or two of when my own father and mother were born. And my mom and dad did what the majority of Americans did after World War II. My dad came back from occupied Berlin. He went into the Army at 18, came back at 20, met my mother, married her, had a child, my brother, in 1948. I was born a number of years after that. And then they settled down and lived the American dream. You know, they got a house in the suburb, a two-car garage, a white picket fence. And the Beats were the opposite of that. They were a small sliver of that greatest generation who didn't follow the rules, who made up own rules, who lived their own ways. I mean, you know, Allen Ginsberg came out of the closet in 1955. And he wrote about it. That was a big deal.
Right.
And so it's interesting that they would take that other approach, and yet they are the ones who got famous. They are the ones, the case can be made, who changed not only the course of America, but the course of the world. And it's because they influenced so many people that have influenced everybody. I mean, Bob Dylan used to follow Ginsberg around. He wanted to be Allen Ginsberg. That's why his lyrics are so poetic. The Beatles changed the spelling of their name from the Silver Beatles, B-E-E-T-L-E-S, to B-E-A-T-L-E-S, because they were influenced by the Beat Generation. This is documented. And so there's a lot of impact that they had to an awful lot of people.
That's for sure. You brought up the drugs and the alcohol. I want to bring it up. We've already mentioned loss of Kerouac to the booze. But and the murder and the mayhem, that's all part of the lexicon of the story. But I want to talk to you about, you know, clearly mind-altering substances played a large role in the lives of what some have called the bohemian hedonists. I think that was one of the things that I read somewhere. I thought that was an interesting title. Was that their power, their source of creativity? Would their impact be what it was without them having gone that route? You know, later we can, not with you maybe, but we'll go into the 60s a little bit in the influence, but that drug, that booze, that thing, creative people, what's the deal here? You know, what do you think? Could they have done it without it?
I think the argument could be made in both directions, frankly. And I don't know, I hesitate to really draw a distinction there, because it is what some of them embrace. The drugs were prevalent. Although Allen Ginsberg, in my opinion, seems to use drugs more for searching and questing as opposed to escapism or to bury his wounds, to salve himself, because he used probably a lot more drugs than anybody else, but he didn't use them in excess like some of the other folks did. So being in the writing world, you know, you meet a lot of people who say that they need this creative spark. And frankly, I don't know, maybe other guests can speak to that more clearly than I can, because I'm of the opinion that, you know, whatever gets you through the night, yes, sometimes, but at the same time, you don't want to crash and burn like Jack and Neil did, and it was drugs and booze that did them in. And do you really need that crutch for creativity? I'm not so sure you have to, although if you think you do, you do.
Yeah, I think, but I do think you raise a very good point there, which is you can see it from both points of view, questing or self-examination, not to mention drowning the pain. I think those are all aspects of it, and I think they're important to look at it from that point of view is certainly important to the story. You know, let's talk 1950s. It was an era of two conflicting worlds, that's for sure. It was the Beats, and then there were the button-down set, you know, conflicts of ideas, and ideals, therefore sitting at the heart of it all, rule-breaking, morality redefined in every sense of Americana, marriage, women's roles, art, sex, sexuality, education. First generation, fair to say, that really questioned the grand scheme of it all. You know, here's my question for you, though. It starts with them. Has it been resolved?
Well, possibly. Again, depending on your personal point of view. Sometimes people would say to me, whatever happened to the Beat Generation? What happened to their message? And in my opinion, the Beat Generation and the values that they undertook, they prevailed. I mean, the whole hippie era grew out of the Beat Generation. And what we live with today in society in 2014 grew out of that. I mean, if you think about the values of the Beat Generation, which were tolerance and compassion and, equal rights for women, equal rights for all races and minorities, gay and lesbian rights, even things like environmentalism. They were writing about saving the whales and saving the dolphins back in the 50s. You know, these are common things today. And you mentioned earlier about younger people. We get an awful lot of young people coming in, teenagers coming into our museum all the time, especially people in their 20s. And they are hugely influenced by the Beats because, in essence, they grew up with a sense of this is normal. Of course you treat all races equally. Of course, you know, the kid down the street is gay and I don't care. You know, of course, you know, women are equal to men. Why would anybody even doubt that? And so if you think about how that kind of grew out of that and how the Beats were championing those causes in many ways just years ago, things are always evolving. Things are always changing. And, yeah, things are going to get better. They're going to get extremely better. They have to. It's the march of progress. Again, progressive progress. That's the way we're heading, and this is what happens. Things become more equal. People become recognized. People who were oppressed are no longer oppressed. That's just the march of time, I think.
And I think it's important, though, to also bring up the fact that it started somewhere, and we shouldn't forget that because it didn't come easily. And that's an important point to make. You know, many say that without the Beats, as you just said, that the 60s revolution could never have occurred. And do you think the great voices of the counterculture of the 60s, however, I'm gonna reference Jim Morrison. I did write a book with the Doors about Morrison and did a radio show on him that was kind of famous. But were they merely copycats or symbiotic soldiers taking the message one step or more further, you know?
Yeah, I think you can put it that way. I mean, I wouldn't call them copycats. I mean, they did it in their own way. I mean, rock and roll and music is certainly different than writing and poetry, although in many ways it grew out of that. And the power and the voice was magnified because, you know, I mean, not everybody listened to rock and roll. But Jim Morrison was hugely influenced by the Beats.
Oh, my God, Michael McClure. You know,
there's photographs of him with Michael McClure. They were good friends. And so, I think it's that word evolution that comes to mind, because they were certainly influenced by it. And again, they changed society, too. So it's literally a linear progression in many ways, in my mind.
Talk to me, Ron. When they come to your museum, what are they going to see? The wonderful Beat Museum in San Francisco.
Well, we've got...
City Lights Books, let me just say that. That's the vicinity, right?
Yeah, we call it, it's the heart of North Beach. Lawrence Ferlinghetti calls our intersection the center of the universe, and it is. And, yeah, so we've got lots of great items. We've got personal effects of some of the Beats, like the shirt that Neil Cassidy wore when he drove the bus for Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. We've got a jacket that Kerouac wore when he used to go climbing the mountains during the Dharma Bums era. We've got the car that was used in the making of the film On the Road, which came out last year. The original car that Neil Cassidy owned is long lost to posterity. Nobody has a clue as to what could have happened to it. There's no record of it, frankly, physical record, other than the memories of Kerouac and other people who were there. But the car that was used in the movie, which is an exact replica of it, is inside the museum, which is pretty cool. And so people come to get to look at these items and see the movies and the documentaries in our movie room, and go to the second floor and see some of the personal effects, and come to events. We always have events and readings and book signings and various types of things.
And a great website. So Jerry, the Beat Museum is dedicated to spreading the spirit of the great generation, which is defined, as you've so well defined it, as tolerance, compassion, and having the courage to live individual truth. How are we doing, Jerry, and that?
How are we?
As a country, as a nation.
As a society, I think we're doing better than we've ever done. There's setbacks, We have to deal with things in the news like we've had the last few months. But the fact that it gets so much attention and focus, and so many people are disapproving of these racial rants that are in the headlines, and, you watch what happens with the football draft the other night, he says, So yeah, definitely, things are improving. Our society is expanding. We are becoming a more enlightened society.
I like a positive guy, and he's got a really positive place in the Beat Museum. I want you all to go when you're in the Bay Area to go see it, because it really is a pretty terrific place. It's open, by the way, every day of the week, right? 10 to 7?
Yes.
It's on Broadway.
7 days a week.
In San Francisco, across from the famous City Lights bookstore. And for more information on the museum and the Beats, visit, I love this, www.kerouac.com. Hey, Jerry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Hallie. Appreciate it. Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Bye-bye.
Brenda Knight is a 20-year publishing veteran beginning her storied career at HarperCollins. She's the author of the American Book Award-winning Woman of the Beat Generation, Rituals for Life and Wild Women, and books. She's worked with many best-selling authors, including Mark Nepo, Philip Goudineau, and Paola Coelho. I can never say his name, Brenda Paola Coelho. She is founding editor of Viva Editions, a division of Calise Book Press, and in her spare time, Ms. Knight volunteers for the American Cancer Society as a counselor for the newly diagnosed, and also leads a Putting Your Passion on Paper writing workshop. And I am very pleased to have Ms. Brenda Knight with us to talk about her truly, hear it, I'm saying it three times, Brenda, truly important work, Woman of the Beat Generation. Welcome to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, Brenda Knight. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. I really enjoyed your chat with Jerry.
Isn't he a fun man?
Yeah, oh, that museum is really something. Incredible place.
I know, and he's such a devoted guy. God bless him. I love it. So listen to me, Dron. The old saying goes that behind every man is a woman. But I think that the women of the Beat Generation changed that to right next to every man sits an equally powerful, talented, intelligent, creative, and groundbreaking woman. What do you say, lady?
I agree, absolutely. And in some cases, they may have been lotus position on the floor playing a bongo or something. Which is exactly what happened at the big critical moment when the Beats burst forth at that Six Gallery reading, where Allen Ginsberg, Red Hal, and Kerouac, and Cassidy, and Ginsberg, and Ferlinghetti, and all the players were there, including Joanna McClure, who was writing just as much poetry as anyone else. But that was like the real critical moment, and it was filled with women poets, artists, and beat girls.
And don't you just love it? You know, it's unbelievable how important the women you talk about in your very, and I'm not joking about this, is an important book, and everybody should have a copy of it and read it, The Woman of the Beat Generation. But it's important to understand how powerful these women are to the history, not of the time, but even now when you think about it. And yet, talk about the Beat Generation, and it's Kerouac and Burroughs and Ginsberg, and the women get so little mention. What's the story about that? I never got that.
You know, I think it's getting a little better every year, thanks to my book and some others that are emerging, and also the movies where the women are right there beside Jack and Neil. But I think it goes back to a little bit about what you and Jerry Cimino were talking about. There was the movie star, you know, brotherly duo, the beatnik bromance, why don't we call it that, Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy. And, you know, they were so charismatic and wild, and he and Kerouac captured that moment. You know, he captured those early years of, like, when the Beats burst forth in On the Road. And so I think that, but I also tell people that the women didn't have a good publicist as the men did, because that was Allen Ginsberg. You know, Allen Ginsberg did work in advertising. There is, even in Mad Men, there's like a little character, an ad man, and his name is Ginsberg, and that's them tipping their hat to the fact that Allen Ginsberg was in advertising. And so he would go around on the streets of New York to all the agents and publishers and knock on their doors and pitch them his and Kerouac and Burroughs and even Cassidy's writings. And he got turned down a lot, but eventually somebody said yes. And then nobody knew marketing and publicity like Allen Ginsberg. So the women were often writing their poetry, making their art, writing their novels, creating. But they were also raising the kids. In the case of Carolyn Cassidy, she was working two jobs while also painting and writing and raising the kids. She was the breadwinner while Neil rode around the country. So the women were doing the housework, raising the kids, being the breadwinners in most cases, and also doing their art. And so they didn't have time to get out there and work it like Ginsberg.
So much has not changed, has it, my friend?
Right.
You had some things you wanted to say about these women, changing mores, questioning ideals, transforming relationships with their men, an era critical to the future of the women's movement. But talk to me, the times are changing. You know, within the scope of what you just said and what I just said, how much? Fascinating.
I think we've come a very long way. In the case of the women, I loved what Jerry was saying about how the beatniks paved the way for the hippies. In fact, Neil Cassidy drove the car in On the Road and drove the bus in the electric Kool-Aid acid test. And so the women were just as experimental in their lifestyle, even more so. They were even more daring than their counterpart men, because they were supposed to be the little house dress and they were supposed to be the little housewife and the perfect little house dress with the perfect little apron and the perfect two kids and the perfect chicken in every pot. And so they had to break the chains of the domesticity. If they weren't full-time mothers, working at home as domestic engineers, they were supposed to be secretaries. What's really funny is that when I was interviewing many of the women, and that was one of the joys of my existence in the 90s, was that I went all over. I went to New York, Minneapolis, Chicago, Michigan, L.A., all over, tracking the women down, because I didn't want to just do it over the phone. I wanted real first-person, in-person interviews and transcripts. And several of them said they didn't take typing in high school because they wouldn't have to just become a secretary, and that then when they wanted to write their poetry, they were self-taught typists, including Ruth Weiss, who's going to be at Jerry's Museum this Friday reading her poetry.
I think it's so much fun when you look back at all of this. So we'll talk about it again in a minute in a different incarnation. But you set out to set the record straight, and I love that, and record these women's histories. And let's begin then with some of the names. Who, in your opinion, of the women that you write about and women of the Beat Generation made the most important contribution? Or perhaps the question should be, who of the women was the most well-known?
Oh, well, that's a pretty easy answer. That's Diane de Prima, who is still writing and still a major force and had the honor of being a San Francisco poet laureate, did a magnificent job. And so she was real feisty, and she, it's incredible. She's exactly, I imagine that she's exactly like she was then, a real truth teller, really strong, really honest, sometimes to the point where you think you can't take all that honesty. And she was reading her poetry in Greenwich Village, you know, Memoirs of a Beatnik. There's that beautiful photo of her on the cover with her groovy sandals and her little beatnik outfit and her long hair and beautiful face. And she stood beside the men just as strong as them, just by sheer force of her will and the power of her mind. So I think because she was doing it so long, and she wouldn't stand behind any man. She would stand in front of, if anything, and that's where she deserves to be. And so she's been doing it the longest, I think, with the most notoriety. And, of course, she also did her own publishing, like little early zines and underground presses and things like that. That was a really important thing that many poets and many women poets, that was the only choice they could get. No publishing house wasn't going to publish, you know, them. So they were going to have to publish themselves, and she did that, and I talk about that a lot. She had 3 or 4 underground presses in New York with Amiri Baraka, then he was Leroy Jones. Then she moved out to San Francisco, joined the Diggers, which was sort of the proto-hippies, where they were, like, feeding the poor, fighting against the wars, and also, you know, doing underground publishing. And so I think she was doing it the longest and got the most notoriety by the fact that she didn't wait for a publisher to come find her. She published herself. Pretty brilliant move. So I'd say she is the most well-known. And I would say that her very good friend, Lenore Kendall, was also right up there with her. And when people talk about the Howell trial, which is, of course, you know, the infamous moment that Jerry Cimino talked about a little bit with you, about when Lawrence Ferlinghetti was on trial for obscenity, publishing obscenity, I always say, wait a minute, there were 2 obscenity trials within the Beat era, and there was the first one was actually Lenore Kendall, because she published her controversial love book, which was very, she called it her holy book, and it was very sensual and very erotic. And this is in 1963 and 64 that she was reading this and putting this together. So she actually did find a publisher that was brave enough, which was the Psychedelic Press. So they were, they got a police raid. Everyone was put in jail, including her, in 1965. And when she was challenged in court, you're going to love this. This is what she said. She defended the love book as a 23-year search for an appropriate way to worship and an attempt to express her belief that sexual acts between loving persons are religious acts. So that's pretty brilliant. She was, like, basically using, like, sort of the American Constitution against itself and saying that she was free to worship, and that this, you know, her love book was her expression of her faith. I'm sorry, that is genius.
Genius, and I love a lady with eggs.
Yeah.
big eggs. Listen, we got to take a quick break here. But before we talk some more about these terrific women who remained under the radar for far too long, let me put you on hold, Brenda, while we take that moment to recognize our sponsors. When we come back, more with Brenda Knight, author of Women of the Beat Generation, and then my conversation with the brilliant Alan Kaufman, author of Drunken Angels. So stay with us. We will be right back. You are listening to The Hallie Kaiser-Jane Show, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kaiser-Jane Show. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. By the way, look for Brenda Knight's Woman of the Beat Generation, as read by Deborah Winger.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
We are back on the Hallie Kaiser-Jane Show, where today we're talking about the Beat Generation. Welcome back, Brenda Knight, author of Women of the Beat Generation. Brenda, before we go any further, we've got to go here. I want to discuss these women in terms of literature itself. To understand their contribution to the art form, I think we have to go back a little bit in history. Until they emerge as these are my words, okay? They're like a proletariat of literature. I think that it's fair to say that literature was the purview of the elite up until this time. Do you agree with that?
Oh yes, there were sort of caught with the formalists, you know, the T.S. Eliots and et cetera, who are like major influences, important to read. I still think one must read the canon, and of course create your own canon. And so I think that's what I really tried to do in terms of completing the Beat canon, which was only half up to this point. Very few women really had been published up until Women of the Beat Generation. And so there's a couple of them where you can see the influences of the formalist poets, and they cite, you know, for example, Diane de Prima herself, like, you know, cites them as major influences, but then she also said that, like, she had to break away and find her own freedom, and, like, you have to sort of know a form before you can break it and break free of it. And so in many cases, that's what the women did. One of my personal favorite discoveries was Elise Cohen, whose poems had never been published until my book, because they were moldering in a basement in Minneapolis, because her family, basically just, like, you know, dumped her, said, "You're not our relative," because she hung out with beatniks. She was actually Allen Ginsberg's last girlfriend. He met Peter Orlovsky when he was together with Elise. He figured out he was really gay. Then she figured out she was really a lesbian. And her family, who were like upper middle class Jews in New York, couldn't handle that. And so they kicked her out of the family. She came running out to San Francisco to find Kerouac and everybody and join forces. Somehow it was all these missed connections, and she didn't really find her place in San Francisco. So she made her way back to New York. And by this time, she's pretty depressed and lonely and sad and feeling ill. And then she was put in a mental hospital by her family. And then she broke out through the window and, like, you know, fell to her death. So her poems were lost in a box in Minneapolis. I did this sort of literary detective work to find her, and her poems are brilliant, and I really think of her as the beat Emily Dickinson. There's a spare beauty and elegance to her poetry that I think is very rare. And, I mean, I feel like I just was lucky. It's not like I'm really that good of a detective. Otherwise, I guess I would be a detective. But I feel like that's one of my real moments where I found something important and was able to share that with the world. Otherwise, Elise Cohen's poetry might have been lost forever.
And what a gift it is that you found that for all of us to go read. Fascinating. I have just a second more, and so I'm going to storm through this. Boy, I wish I had more time. But there are many who complain that women are too much like men these days, and men have become too much like women. But the women of the Beat Generation might have been the first to cast the wind to gender specifics. And I just quickly, let's explore that, and I mean quickly, because I have two more that I have to ask you. What do you think on that thought?
You know, I kind of agree with that. I mean, actually, even there's like, I gathered many, many photographs. The women were so generous with the photographs they gave me, rare archival ones. And there's many of them that are, you know, wearing trousers and pants and even like sailor outfits and stuff like that. And I don't think they had any intention of doing drag or cross-dressing or anything. I think they wanted to wear what was comfortable, what they thought was cool. And they didn't want to wear those house dresses, for God's sake, like they're artists. So
well,
they're really pearls. Like, they were really expressing themselves as artists, what, you know, beyond gender, beyond any expression of sexuality or gender. I think they wanted to be perceived as who they really were.
And I love that. And you know, it's funny, my assistant found a photograph today of Audrey Hepburn dressed like the Beat Generation. It's a phenomenal photo.
Oh, yeah.
We'll use it. Yeah, we're going to use it in some of the push in this show in the next week, so you'll have to come and look at it. But
I will.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But it's a style generated by these women of that certain black stocking era that catapulted expression by the women as kind of progenitors of fashion, not copycats of stylist icons. You know, they actually used how they expressed themselves through their clothes of their choice. And I don't know up until then if that had ever been done by women in fashion. You know, they always were fed their concepts. They didn't create.
Uh-huh.
In the street, they do that. And they do it a lot more today. There's a lot more individualism. But I wanted to throw that in the mix before I go to my last moment with you. I want to read you a quote.
Yeah, you know, I think it had been done very rarely. I think that during the Napoleonic era in France, there were there was like a little, like there were sort of like, you know, 19th century punk rockers. What did they call themselves? It was something like the Fabuloso, and they were like young artsy men and women, and they would dress like half of them would be like half of them would be a woman, and then the other half would be a man. And again, it wasn't any expression of like sexuality or anything like that. They were trying to express who they were, and I keep trying to research them because I'm fascinated. I heard about them once from a lecture that I attended, and so I think when it happens, it's very special. And I will tell you, I know we only have one second left, but you could, back in the day in the 60s, you could rent a beatnik. Ted Jones, J-O-A-N-S, he passed away a few years ago. He was one of the black beats, African-American beats, and he realized there was an entrepreneurial opportunity, and so he and his friends, he had a phone number, rent a beatnik, and you could call him up, and he would bring his girl and guy friends in their beatnik regalia and bongos, and they would come fancy up your party and make you cool and give you cool points. So you could rent a beatnik.
I love it. Don't you love it? I'm going to close this segment, Brenda, with this, that a quote from Jack Kerouac. The truth of the matter is we don't understand our women. We blame them, and it's all our fault. Which tells me one thing. Were they ahead of their time?
they were so far ahead of their time. They're still ahead of their time. When I read the poetry, it still is fresh, whether it's Ruth Weiss, Elise Kellen, Diane DePrima, Denise Levertov, whoever it is, there's raw and shocking freshness. So they are still ahead of our time.
The author, Brenda Knight, the book, Woman of the Beat Generation. You must pick this up. It's fantastic. For more information on Brenda and her work, visit www.vivaeditions.com. Hey, Brenda. Thank you, darling.
Thank you. I enjoyed this so much.
Me too. You have a great one.
Okay, you too.
Praised by authors as diverse as Hubert Zelby Jr., Dave Eggers, and David Mamet, grace the books of San Francisco author and poet Alan Kaufman. Alan is the author of two critically acclaimed memoirs, Jew Boy and Drunken Angel, and a novel, Matches. He is also the editor of, among others, the best-selling anthologies, The Outlaw Bible of American Poetry. He recently co-directed the Allen Ginsberg Festival. He's co-founder with Clayton Patterson of the Acker Awards, an annual tribute given to members of the International Avant-Garde Underground. Alan Kaufman's personal story is as riveting as the lives of the talented people he has crossed paths with, Allen Ginsberg, Kathy Acker, Anthony Burgess, Elie Wiesel, Isaac Singer, and Bernard Malamud. Often compared to the likes of Jack Kerouac, Henry Miller, and Ernest Hemingway, he is also a leading voice of the children of Holocaust survivors. What a pleasure to have Alan as my guest on the Hallie Kester-Jane Show. He's been a gem to sit here and wait. How are you, Alan? Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Alan, I got to tell you something,
yes,
buddy. I want to ask you why, in your opinion, and I'm a Jewish girl, so I'm feeling free to
okay.
So many Jews were sitting at the front and center at the heart of the Beat of Bennett generation. Was the Jewish disenchantment with the status quo a natural reaction to the horrors of World War II? How is that?
Well, World War II, I'm glad you mentioned that, because nobody mentioned the fact of the Holocaust, of the death camps, of the horrific images that came out of Europe at that time, and also of Hiroshima, you know. And it's no accident that a reaction would set in among Jewish poets and writers like Allen Ginsberg, even if not overtly stated and, you know, specifically addressed. There was a revulsion and a horror, not just of, you know, Europe and not just of, you know, what the Nazis did, but of civilization itself. I mean, I was kind of smiling when I heard Jerry's, you know, very optimistic, you know, take on things, because here we were at the high point of human civilization, you know, and we have the Nazis, and a lot of Europeans participated in the Holocaust, you know, producing the greatest horror in human history, and of course it was most specifically focused, you know, on the Jews. So when Allen Ginsberg stands up in 1956 at the Gallery 6 in San Francisco and, you know, proclaims his poem Howl, what he references is Malach, Old Testament imagery of corruption and evil and of destruction. So I think that was, you know, a key, you know, fact, you know, that contributed to many Jews drifting into the Beat Generation. You know, they were looking for an alternative.
And it was
just
fascinating.
Kind of having your book published was not enough, you know.
But before we get into them in more detail, tell me about you. First, let me just say this. I just read Drunken Angel, which I had not read. Oh, my God. What a tour de force. Seriously. I mean, really and truly, this is a book. No, I'm going to rant about this. That's how good this book is. I just tell you, I didn't sleep. I stayed up all night finishing it. I was that riveted. But your life, your ups, your downs, your triumph over the unspeakable is a lesson for us all. And life didn't begin well for you, and I want to talk about that. And that's a theme that courses through your veins, kind of like alcohol did for so many years, and that is loneliness and a sense of alienation, a theme that was so much a part of this Beat generation. Talk to me about that.
Well, my mother was a French-Jewish Holocaust survivor, married to a Bronx Jewish street guy. She was living in, you know, poverty with, you know, we were living in poverty in the Bronx. So, you know, my Harry Potter stories when I was a child were stories of, you know, the Holocaust. She didn't have anyone at that time to really speak to about it. I remember there was one woman named Ruth who used to come by with numbers on her arms. She was a German Jew who had been at Auschwitz. And they would kind of hang out together now and then. But by and large, there was no discussion of the Holocaust at that time. And so she was very locked in a kind of horrifying memory, you know, and extremely marginalized by that memory and her experiences in the Holocaust. And the person who she found she could talk to about it was me when I was a kid. I was riveted. I was spellbound by her stories. So I became kind of her confidant, the one she didn't have anywhere else. And you know, the problem with that also is that she had illness, mental illness issues of a severe kind, and she lost the baby at term when I was 5 years old. And suddenly she flipped from, and suddenly she flipped from being the most loving, beautiful woman in the world to, you know, somebody who was deeply scarred, you know, haunted, and beginning to hit me, you know, to hit out at and strike
beat
out
the,
at me.
Yeah, beat the crap out of you.
Well, yeah, she was, you know, kind of, she was bestowing on me love, like a lot of love, and also historical transmission, memory, and at the same time physical violence. Very confusing mixture.
I can just imagine, or maybe I can't. I bring this up maybe I haven't thought about it until now, but what happened in Germany didn't die in Germany. You and I both know that. It's not dead today.
Of course not.
And I don't know that you can look at that generation and what happened during the Beat era without understanding just how powerful that the disease continued. It may have morphed into other things, but there it was affecting society. The ravages of the Nazis, I think a lot of people don't understand, live on in children and grandchildren and generations. It's like a DNA was changed, altered, you know, for life, and affected how a lot of these people thought. And therefore, I don't think you can look at the Beat generation and even the 50s without a conversation about the Holocaust and its legacy on American values or on its culture.
I completely agree with you. I think that the Beat generation were a direct consequence of the Holocaust.
And I do, too. And it's just not something that's spoken about a lot. You know, there's a lot of romance.
It's never
to this.
Spoken about.
Right.
It's never spoken about.
Well, we just did, darling.
You and I are breaking new ground right here.
Here on the Haley Kessler Jane Show, get the thought out. It's fact. It is what it is, and it needs to be addressed. But here's where I want to say is, for you, it affected you, and that was so powerful when I watched you grow and change and find yourself little by little across, you know, this book of yours, which is this memoir of yours, I should say, of your life. You seem to have found a certain solace in the world of the Beats. And what was it that you found there that fixed it eventually? Because it led to your getting fixed, if you will.
Well, you know, for one thing, it presented an alternative narrative, an alternative way of being to what was around me. In other words, my mother's anguish, which she imparted to me, and the historical wounding, which she imparted to me, you know, in and of itself was incredibly important. It, you know, she transmitted a kind of civilizational distrust of civilization, if you will. You can't trust civilization. But what do you do instead? Well, she didn't have any alternatives. She didn't have any answers to that. So when I first read, you know, two books, one was On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and the other one was actually Kaddish. Before I read Howl, I read Allen Ginsberg's magnificent poem to Naomi, Kaddish. I was riveted. I mean, this changed my life. Kerouac, you know, presents a picture of life and a way of being which is against the grain. It's against civilization, you know, messages. It's against conformity. Conformity was a big issue for me. I was very concerned about, scared of conformity, if you will. Conform to what? You know, conform into somebody who's going to be gassed by society? You know, that's how I looked at it. So, you know, it was against conformity. And, you know, it also offered a picture of freedom, of liberation. Get out on the road, hitchhike, do things differently. And Ginsberg's poem, Kaddish, is about a very haunted, mentally ill mother. And I immediately took to his story and to that poem. It's like, wow, his mother, Naomi, was also, you know, kind of mentally ill. And look, he's transformed this into literature. He's done something with this. He's not just wounded by it, but he's turned the wound into literature. So that was very, very important to me. And so those two guys became certainly heroes for me.
What was Ginsberg like?
Well, you know, the first time I met Ginsberg, you know, I was still young, and I was about 18 or 19, and I heard that he was reading at Columbia University, so I jumped on the subway. I was living on the Upper West Side at that point. I went down to Columbia University, and I walked into this hall where he was sitting in a chair dressed in white flowing robes with long hair, balding, playing a harmonium, and all of these kind of hippies sitting on the floor. And I had come expecting him to read Howl and Kaddish. I mean, I wanted to hear the great poet read his great poems. And instead he was playing the harmonium and chanting Om. He was sitting there chanting Om, Om, like for like an hour. And then that was the end of the reading. So I went up to him after the reading. I said, excuse me, Mr. Ginsberg. I was very angry. I was like, I came all the way to see you read Howl and Kaddish. Why don't you read those poems? And he goes, He was a character, you know. And he was always trying to be a teacher. You know, whenever you were with him, you felt that he was trying to impart some kind of teaching, some kind of lesson. He very much saw himself as an example of something. And so that was, you know, one time his arm. He was also incredibly helpful. Like in the early 90s, when I led the strike against City Hall in San Francisco on behalf of poets who had been shut down by the police, poetry readings were shut down by the police here in 93. He kind of guided my hand with, you know, what to do and, you know, how to organize. He was very, very helpful. He was very helpful to the unknown. He would reach out to the unknown poet, or he would, you know, respond to the unknown poets. And I thought that was a measure of his greatness and why so many liked him, you know, and stayed devoted to his work. And then I was in Berlin with him in 94 at the Berlin Jewish Cultural Festival, and by that time he was very ailing. His health was failing, and he was very frail, and when he got up on the stage to perform, he suddenly was transformed into a lion. I mean, I was amazed. I mean, all the vitality and the power came out. But also, you know, there was a side of him that was a little naive. I mean, he was brilliant, and you know, he masterminded the Beat Generation. He was a public relations genius. You know, he used to work in public relations before he became a famous poet. So he was all of that, but he was also a little naive. And the reason I say that is that we were in Berlin, and there was a press conference with me and Alan and Jerome Rothenberg, another poet. And the media, somebody asked him about Hitler and about the Nazis and the Holocaust. And he said, I thought naively, if, you know, Hollywood stars had stood up and opposed Hitler, the Holocaust would not have happened. And I remember this. he said that. And I remember this German journalist tapping me on the arm and looked at me like, is he crazy? And I said, Alan, excuse me. With all due respect, do you really think that Shirley Temple and Gary Cooper could have stopped
him? Wow. Yeah. Interesting.
Like, you're doing all that sense. He became very angry at me. And I said, well, I disagree. And he became very angry at me. But then he changed course. And he suddenly said, this is Alan Kaufman. He's one of the rising young writers and poets. And Alan, I'm sorry I got so angry at you. You're entitled to your opinion. So I thought that showed something. You know, the fact that he could kind of publicly back down like that and apologize.
You know what thought just ran through my mind?
He's a little naive. You know, there was a kind of naivete.
But the thought that ran through my mind is if he was a PR man at his core, he probably thought Hollywood could PR its way through Hitler and that would be the end of it. I mean, you know, you don't know how these guys
think.
Well,
that's very American. That's a very American belief, you know. If you think
for sure.
It.
Absolutely.
It's an American core value, you know, that we can PR our way through anything.
Well,
but
yeah.
Unfortunately,
well,
that's not.
That's for sure. I want to talk to you about this. You, obviously, Drunken Angel, and I love that title, Drunken Angel. We both know that you were, thank God, able to pull yourself out of the drunken side of that. And, well, you've been sober now for, what, 25-something years, I think it is.
23.
And 23, and, you know, applause. But you drank your way through a lot of your life before you got sober. What was the key for you?
What
was the key? What was the way out for you?
Well, you know, I ended up hitting the streets. I was living in the East Village in Tompkins Square Park and drinking myself to death. And I encountered a poet there one night who was actually a very famous poet, Jim Brody. He was known in the poetry world. And I was, Jim, you know, how did you end up here in the gutter with me? I mean, you're a famous poet. And he told me, basically, he kind of ran it down for me, you know, that, you know, this is a disease, alcoholism is a disease, and that there's something called recovery one can go to, that one can enter into, that, you know, can save one from this disease. And he, you know, he said to me, you don't belong here. You know, he says, you're not a street guy. You're not, you know, you really should not be here. And, you know, I think you can get out. And so he died, actually. And of, you know, AIDS-related causes. This was in, you know, the late 80s. And but the fact that somebody was, you know, dying, and he said, I'm dying of AIDS, and I, you know, I'm a junkie. The fact that somebody could be dying and yet want to impart a message of hope to me and give me that information was very stirring to me. I was very inspired, and it gave me hope. It gave me hope there at the bottom of the night. I did, you know, enter into recovery, and it worked. You know, I've been clean and sober 23 years, and all the output that I've done as a writer has come in the last 23 years. All that's been good in my life has come from that. And some of my heroes, I found out, were also in recovery, including some of my beat heroes. So.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you said that. One, I worked on this book, as I said, about Jim Morrison, and spent a lot of my time doing my bit with his crazy life and what happened to him. And you know, one of the things that scares me is this badge that sometimes is placed on those that succumb to the bottle or to drugs. You know, it's almost a badge of honor, you know. And I think that that's a very scary thing to... celebrate that part of their legacy, which is something that is done, and it's not something I approve of. I want to ask you about humor in the Beat Generation. Is there such a thing?
Yeah, I mean, the Beats were at heart, you know, comic. I mean, they, you know, they did have a comic view of life. Sometimes, you know, the only response to great darkness is to laugh, you know. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, Yiddish, Jewish humor, you know, in a way that the Beat Generation and this kind of clowning at life, you know, is a way of making fun. You know, I wanted to say also that, you know, in terms of things like, you know, you'd mentioned, I'd heard in the other discussions about women and the Beat Generation, and you know, at the heart of the degeneration were two very important women who I didn't hear mention. One was Allen Ginsberg's mother, Naomi, who's the subject of his most major poem, I think, is Kaddish. It's an incredible poem. It's a full-length book, full-length poem. And, you know, who was a Jewish socialist, you know, woman who went mad. And the other one is Jack Kerouac's mother, Gabrielle, who was, you know, absolutely, you know, integral to his life. You know, a lot of the times when he wrote, he would go home to Gromaire, to her house, and sit there and write. You know, he wasn't out there writing and getting drunk and smashed and doing drugs. He was home being a good son in Gromaire's house and typing on his little typewriter. And Ginsberg was obsessed with Naomi. He was he ended up living on the Lower East Side where she came from, you know. He was obsessed with his mother. So those were two women who were very powerful forces. And it's safe to say, in a way, that the Beat Generation was born from them, in a way, you know, from these two women. The other thing it's also something I've never talked about, you know, the mothers. But I think
mothers are, I would say, are critically important, including your mother, because at the end of the day...
My mother, I can't stop writing about my mother. She's
right.
Fashioned my worldview. And then another
you're
thing...
You're so
about,
Jewish,
about women,
darling. You're so Jewish.
It's so Jewish, right? And then another thing is that there's a matter of social risk, because, you know, at that time, there were many women like Mary McCarthy and Jean Stafford and who else? Elizabeth Hardwick and who else? Carolyn Gordon. These were major, you know, figures. Diana Trilling. These were major intellectual figures, authors of books that were nationally read and acclaimed. So you could be a famous woman writer at the time. But to be a famous woman writer around the Partisan Review crowd and the commentary crowd and all of that didn't carry with it any social risk. The women who aligned themselves with the Beat Generation weren't just aligning themselves with you know, an alternative view of literature, but they were aligning themselves with enormous social risk. I mean, if you got involved with the Beat Generation and you were a woman, you weren't just facing, you know, disapproval from the literary establishment, but you were facing the possibility of jail. You were facing the possibility of complete, you know, disbarment from your family and from society. So
taking
a huge chance,
Right.
And the other thing I just wanted to state is that you know, the heroes of the Beat Generation were by and large queer. Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, Kerouac was certainly bisexual, and also Neal Cassady was, you know, Allen Ginsberg's lover and also Carolyn Cassady's husband. I mean, there was a lot of queerness and bisexuality going on in the Beat Generation, and that may also have contributed to their kind of exclusivity, male exclusivity. They were not that interested in women, but for the most part. They were interested in men. There's a book by Regina Walker called Queer Beats that's actually published by Clea's Press, by Brenda's publishing house, so that talks about that. And that's also part of the narrative that's often left out.
And I think it's a good point to make, not irrelevant, that's for sure. Let me take you to two other points, and then we really do have to go. Do you worry the darkness and pain, angst, bongo drums, dark, smoke-filled coffee houses, little beatniks along with the death of Sylvia Plath and Bell Jars, listen to me, Martin Miller and George Maharis traveling down Route 66 in the Corvette are bound to become the cliched image of what as a time that was a real cultural altering future generation. You worry about it being pigeonholed, made fun of, twisted into something commercial that it wasn't?
Well, you know, there is, you know, America is commodification. I mean, that's what happens here. You know, we commodify. You know, the culture commodifies. The economy commodifies. It's just the given of America. We commodify. And so, you know, we commodify and merchandise and so forth. But something that is truly insurgent, something that is authentically insurgent, such as On the Road, cannot be commodified. You know, you can put William Burroughs, as happened, in a Sony commercial, and William Burroughs is still insurgent. You look at his face, and there's a message there of rebellion and, you know, get out of the house and get out and do something different. You read On the Road in the New American Library, you know, edition printed on satin paper and beautiful and all that, and it's still a, you know, a call to rebellion, a call to freedom. So, no, I don't worry about that too much. I think that what I do worry about is what aspects of Beat are being imparted. You know, what is being communicated? And I think it's very important, things like Jerry's Museum, people like Brendan Knight and Women of the Beat Generation, to impart the correct vision of what Beat really was, and then also for historians to open up new doors, i.e., you know, the Beats intersecting with the Holocaust. What about that? The Beats intersecting with, you know, gay culture. What about that? I think that's important because it keeps us true to what was really going on, and that, and the truth cannot be commodified. You can wrap the truth in a commercial. You can wrap, you know, authentic insurgency in something that seems to be, you know, some kind of, you know, merchandise or superficial, but it's not. It the reality of it, the truth of it, always comes through, always. And I think that's really important.
Well, that's good. And, you know, and as a writer and as one of our great writers of a generation, I guess my last thing would have to be to ask you how you feel about how their legacy is affecting the contemporary literary scene.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I do transact with a lot of young writers. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of them, and you know what? They read On the Road. They read Howl. You know, some kid out in Wichita, some young lady or young guy will pull that book off the shelf and read it, and next thing you know, they're out, thumbs out on the highway. Next thing you know, they're heading to San Francisco to go visit the Beat Museum and hang out in North Beach. So I believe that the spirit of it is still alive. I believe that it's alive in young people. However, you know, young people have to realize that the situation that they are in right now with, you know, America as is, with high tech and hyper-capitalism and all this pressure to make money and be illiterate and go out and get drunk and take drugs and do all, and be superficial, is the same pressure that was on the Beats when they were young. You know, it was the same pressure towards conformity, towards money, towards, you know, saluting, you know, the infrastructure, saluting, you know, the corporation, saluting the power structure, being a good robot. And they rebelled. So, you know, and they were just a handful when they started. So just, you know, to say to the young people out there, you know, that it's up to you, you know, to take a stand. It's up to you to rebel against conformity. And I think that rebellion is an important part of growing up. If you don't have rebellion as part of your growing up, you never grow up. If you don't have that as part of your life, you're never going to have a life. So,
well, and as far as I'm concerned, never stop rebelling.
Never stop rebelling.
Never. Otherwise, it just ain't worth it, darling.
That's exactly right.
That's for sure. Oh, my. The book, Drunken Angel, the author, the wonderful Alan Kaufman. Alan, you got to come back. Promise me you'll come back. We'll go down this road. All right, darling. Thanks so much for being my guest on the Hallicaster Jane Show.
All right.
Thanks, John. Bye-bye. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Castor-Jane Show. The Hallie Castor-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com. Oh, my gosh, a host of other venues. Just Google The Hallie Castor-Jane Show, and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieCastorJane.com, which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. And while you're at HallieCastorJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I will be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Castor-Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Castor-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's the HallieCastorJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieCastorJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So till we meet again, that's the story. This is Hallie Castor-Jane. It's a wrap.